Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is an enthusiasm of mine, I want to say first of all, so I'm hoping that you will enjoy this evening as much as I know I'm going to. Life's but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. Heard no more. Well, with the development of Edison's phonograph in the 1880s, the ephemeral art of the actor found a little more permanence. Never again would a famous actor after his death be heard no more, and future generations would be able to judge for themselves whether his reputation was justified. If only we could have heard the voice of Richard Burbage, the first great performer of Hamlet, speaking Shakespeare as its author pronounced it to him. Or hear for ourselves whether it was true that the great 18th century actor David Garrick really did speak Shakespeare with his native Lichfield accent. Yet would we have been impressed by what we heard? Well, here is Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree, as Mark Antony in Julius Caesar, recorded in 1906.
Oh, pardon me, thou bleeding beast of earth, but I am meek and gentle with thee. Thou art the ruins of the noblest man that ever lived in the tide of time. Woe to the hand that shed this costly blood. Over thy wounds now do I prophesy, which like dumb mouths do bear ruby lips, who beg the voice and utterance of my tongue. A curse shall light upon the limbs of men, domestic fury and fierce civil strife shall cumber all the paths of Italy. Blood and destruction shall be so in use, and dreadful objects so familiar, that mothers shall but smile when they behold their infants quartered with the hands of war, all pity choked with custom of fell deeds, and Caesar's spirit ranging for revenge, with Ate by his side, come hot from hell, shall in these confines, with a monarch's voice, cry havoc, and let slip the dogs of war, that this foul deed shall smell above the earth, with carrion men groaning for burial.
Well, with that recording of Tree, we are taken very firmly back into the heart of Edwardian theatre. A performance of tremendous size and power, an aria, in fact, in its musicality, and yet it does sound to us, of course, heavy, slow, mechanical, making no concessions at all to the primitive science of recorded sound. It is, though, a record of what was acknowledged to be, by all who saw it, a great stage performance. Between the late 1890s and 1917, Herbert Beerbohm Tree mounted 16 lavish Shakespearean productions at his own theatre, which he built, called Her Majesty's in the Haymarket. In 1898, he mounted an epic production of Julius Caesar with sets by Alma Tadema, and large, carefully choreographed crowd scenes involving scores of supernumeraries. And in choosing which part to play in his own production, he wrote, for the scholar, Brutus, for the actor, Cassius, for the public, Antony. He chose the public. Tree had the common touch. He wasn't really an intellectual. He would do anything for effect. He was a showman. He mistrusted all talk about technique, for instance. I have got no technique, he once said. It's a dull thing. It enslaves the imagination. And this from the man who founded the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in 1904. Well, it's almost impossible for us today to imagine the size of these performances, the size of performance that was expected from a Shakespearean actor in particular at the end of the 19th century. Larger and larger theatres had been built, and therefore larger and larger acting stars were required. And for would-be actors, useful manuals were produced as a guide. Here was an extract from one called The Actor's Art by Gustav Garcia. And in it, he analyzes many of the speeches of Shakespeare, and in particular, Mark Antony's oration. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Having said these words with a solemn voice, you look round the assembly and make a pause until the words have produced the desired effect. I come to bury Caesar. Here Mark Antony points with a slow movement of the hand to the body lying on the hearse and at some distance from him, his eyes following the same direction. And then, raising them again, full of grief. Whilst the hand remains in the same position, and he says in a lower tone of voice, not to praise him. The hand having fallen down again, as if powerless. He continues then in a higher pitch. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is often buried with their bones. And then saying in a lower tone, so let it be with Caesar. His hand will again point to the body, whilst the eyes will follow the same direction. After a short pause, he gazes upon the assembly, and dropping his hand, he exclaims, the noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. On this last word, he raises his right hand suddenly, pointing upwards with the first finger, thus adding force to this accusation. And so it goes on. Through very, very detailed directions for every nuance of that speech. And this was Tree's style, captured to perfection there, and captured vocally for us too in that 1906 recording. Though it does make demands on our 21st century ears and a leap back for our imaginations. Tree's lack of technique shows in this recording, actually. He had had no vocal training, and he found difficulty in sustaining the verse and reaching a rhetorical climax. Perhaps that is why his delivery feels as if it's on the edge of being sung. It is constructed like an aria, each line moving up a semitone, actually, until the climax is reached. Until he reaches, let's slip the dogs of war, and then he comes all the way down again, back to the first note that he started on. It's very contrived. It sounds very odd to our ears and a far cry from modern Shakespearean performing styles. And yet, given the size of the theatre he had to fill, this grandiose, unnaturalistic style would, I think, have been very thrilling. Early recordings of Shakespearean actors then are merely a record of their stage performances, an evening in the theatre recaptured. But as recording techniques developed, so actors adapted their playing style to the new medium, giving performances that were shaped for the ear rather than the eye. And I hope that this evening you'll hear this development in the extracts I have chosen for you. So let's now begin at the very beginning. The very first recording of a speech by Shakespeare, as far as can be ascertained, was made appropriately enough by the leading actor of the late 19th century, Sir Henry Irving. And I'd like to say that the quality of the cylinders you're about to hear is very poor indeed. And that's why I have kindly asked the management to supply texts for you for the following four extracts. Don't be disheartened if you find it difficult to follow, because the quality does get better as we go on. But it will help enormously if you follow the text whilst you're listening to Irving and subsequently Edwin Booth and Ellen Terry. because these recordings were made at the very beginning of recorded sound. The phonograph had been developed by an American inventor, Thomas Edison, during the early 1880s, as I'm sure you all know. And in 1888, the personal representative of Edison, a certain Colonel Gouraud, came to England with a prototype of the new phonograph and publicized his employer's new invention by recording some of the most eminent figures in English society. After a dinner party at the Colonel's, Irving was requested to recite something. But he was so nervous, his host said that he was frightened out of his voice. He wrote to Ellen Terry Irving, his leading lady, that was, at the Lyceum, "You speak into it, and everything is recorded. Voice, tone, intonation, everything. You turn a little wheel, and forth it comes, and can be repeated 10,000s of times. Only fancy what this suggests." Well, eventually Irving did master this new technique of directing his voice down a speaking tube, which caused a needle attached to a diaphragm to vibrate and leave an impression of sound waves on a soft wax cylinder. The needle then retraced its journey through the grooves, playing back the recording through a large, conically shaped horn. The bigger the horn, the louder the sound. But Sir Henry was not impressed with the result. "Is that my voice? My God!" The phonograph in those days was, of course, hardly more than a drawing room entertainment, and it was some years away from commercial development. And so the survival of these recordings of Irving is, frankly, little short of a miracle. The first one we're going to hear is a speech from Richard III, which Irving played at the Lyceum in 1877, and this recording probably dates from that time when Colonel Gouraud was collecting recordings in 1888. As Richard, one observer, said of Irving's performance, "He never lost nobility, the nobility of Lucifer."
"Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this sun of York. All the clouds have towered upon our house, in the deep bosom of the ocean, buried. Now are our brows crowned with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hang up for monuments, our stern alarum is the very beating, our dreadful heart is to delightful measure. Grim is it war, that smooth is wrinkled front. And now instead of mounting far-bed steeds to fight the souls of fearful adversaries, he is a ship, the lady's chamber, in the period of the sea. I have not fallen for the audience, nor made to fall for the amorous kingdom. I that am rudely stamped and wantless, majesty, that cut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am cursed to be fair for mortal, cheated of peace, caught and hidden, set before me tight into this breathing world, held half made up than that, so lamely and unfashionable, the dog bargat me as I horse rider. I, in this piece I see pleasure."
And there the phonograph runs out. The cylinders only lasted for about 2 minutes, and unfortunately Irving wasn't able to complete the soliloquy. I think you'll notice there the primitive technique, and there are times when he steps back from the tube, which is why you can't hear him. He obviously forgets that he has to keep his voice right in this aperture, otherwise it doesn't register. The second recording is of Wolsey's speech in Henry VIII. This is quite a well-known recording for people who listen to these things. Irving played this part in 1892, and I think it shows how quickly performers do adapt to new media. Though Irving never took recorded sound seriously, he does seem more at ease in this recording compared to the last one, which leads some scholars to doubt whether this is in fact Irving at all. Or it could be one of his many imitators. He was much imitated by music hall artists and other actors of the day. But for me, as you will notice when you follow it in the text, the odd word slips that he makes, which show that Irving is doing this from memory, and the inclusion of a line which is not written by Shakespeare at the end of the speech makes it all authentic. The extra line, which is not on your text there, added by Irving to cover the dying cardinal's well-documented exit across the Lyceum stage. Irving was famous for his long exits. The extra line is, "Come, Cromwell, let us go in. My spirit is broken. Ah." He then also adds a postscript in his own voice where he says, "I consider that one of the finest tragedies in Shakespeare."
Sir Henry Irving cites an excerpt from King Henry VIII. Ready, Sir Henry. "Cromwell, I did not think of better tears in all my misery, but thou hast forced me out of thy onion throne to play the woman. Blessed by our eyes. And thus I hear thee, Cromwell, and when I am forgotten as I shall be, and lay in dull cold marble, where no mention of me must be heard of, say, I thought thee, say, worthy, who once trod the ways of glory, and sounded all the depths and souls of honor, how thee arose out of his grand horizon, a sure, safe one, so thy master with this, back with my fall, and that the ruin. Cromwell, I charge thee, bring away Amphitron, by that sin fell the angel. How then can man the image of his maker hope to win? Love thyself, blood. Cherish own heart to safety. Corruption wins not more than honesty. Still in thy right hand, carry gentle peace to silence envious tongue. Be just and fear not. Let all the ends thou aimest at be thy country's blood and soul. Then, if thou must, O Cromwell, thou wast the blessed master. O Cromwell, Cromwell, that I but serve my God with half the zeal I serve my king, he would not in my name have left me naked to mine enemies. Come, Cromwell, let us go in. My spirit is broken." I consider that one of the famous passages in Shakespeare.
That was the actual voice of Irving when he wasn't acting but speaking as himself. Even rarer. As you can hear, that's a very damaged cylinder indeed. It is really lucky that we have it. In honesty, Irving's vocal weaknesses are exposed by the cruel medium of recording, and many actors find this to be a problem. Even today, I have to say that not everybody is suited to the audio world from the point of view of their vocal techniques. Once you take away the visual from an actor, you concentrate, of course, entirely on the voice, and that can be a good or a bad thing. Irving's idiosyncratic pronunciation was much commented on by his contemporaries. He pronounced dog as Doug, and famously in The Bells, his great melodrama success, he said, "Tuck the rope from me neck." Take the rope from my neck. These peculiarities are evident in these recordings, though not quite as exaggerated as some of his commentators said at the time. For instance, in Richard III, you may have noticed he said "son of Yark" instead of "son of York." He also said "war" instead of "war" at one point. And Irving was well aware of his deficiencies. He himself had corrected a very bad stammer that he had had since he was a boy, and to make the most of his rather thin voice that he was born with, he used a lot of nasal resonance, and I think that was very evident in both those recordings. He had a rather large nose. But it was not vocal power that made Irving a great actor. It was the whole package. His intensity hypnotized me, wrote an eyewitness. Everything helped, this magnetic power. Irving's strange voice, fantastic bearing, ascetic face, and curious, compelling eyes. How strange it is, Irving once said to his leading lady, Ellen Terry, that I should have made the reputation I have as an actor, with no equipment. My legs, my voice, everything's been against me. For an actor who can't walk, can't talk, and has no face to speak of, I've done pretty well. Sadly, we can only get the briefest glimpse of Irving's mighty talent through these rather primitive recordings. An even rarer glimpse of Ellen Terry's talent, the leading lady who partnered Irving at the Lyceum for so many years, is given in a series of speeches that she recorded to accompany an extensive lecture tour she undertook in America in 1911. This was after she had retired from the stage. And the subject of the lecture was Shakespeare's heroines. No actress was more loved than Ellen Terry by her followers. She was the embodiment of Shakespeare's heroines. As one reviewer said, it was as if she had met and talked with and lived with them all. Ellen Terry did not think her Juliet, which she first played in 1882, was a success. She wrote, "I read everything that had ever been written about her before I had myself decided what she was. It was a dreadful mistake. That was the first thing wrong with my Juliet, lack of original impulse. I wish now that instead of reading how this and that actress had played Juliet, I had gone to Verona and just imagined. Now I understand Juliet better. Now I know how she should be played. But time is inexorable. At 60, know what one may, one cannot play Juliet." Nevertheless, astonishingly, at the age of 63, she made this recording of Juliet. It gives, of course, no idea of the quality of her voice, which was much remarked upon, the sweetness of it. But her youthful energy, which she never seems to have lost, is still in evidence, giving us perhaps a taste of those performances with Irving of more than 30 years earlier.
How if, when I am laid into the tomb, I wake before the time that Romeo comes to redeem me, there, a fearful point, shall I not then be stifled in the vault to whose foul mouth no handsome air breathes in, and there die, strangled, ere my Romeo comes? Or, if I live, is it not very like the horrible conceit of death and night, together with the terror of the place, as in a vault, an ancient receptacle, where for these many hundred years the bones of all my buried ancestors are packed, where bloody gibbet, yet the green in earth, lies festering in his shroud, where, as they say, at some hours in the night, spirits resort. Alas, alas, is it not like that I, so early waking, what with loathsome smells, and shrieks like mandrakes torn out of the earth, the living mortals hearing them run mad? Oh! If I wake, shall I not be distraught, environed with all these hideous fears, and madly play with my forefather's choice, and pluck the mangled gibbet from his shroud, and with this rage, with some great kinsman's bone, as with a club, dash out my desperate brain? Oh! Look, methinks I see my cousin's ghost, seeking out Romeo, that it spit his body upon a rapier's point. Oh, stay, Tybalt, stay! Oh, Romeo, I come, this do I drink to.
Well, I don't know about you, but I still find that very compelling, actually. Despite her age and the changing fashions of speech, pronunciation, etc., I still get a shiver down my spine every time I hear that. There are, unfortunately, I should say at this point, next to no recordings of actresses from this period, apart from Ellen Terry. It's a great shame, much to be regretted. There isn't really a decent early recording of an actress doing Shakespeare until Sybil Thorndike in the 1930s. Across the Atlantic, the great Shakespearean tragedian and Irving's contemporary was Edwin Booth. Now, he came from a theatrical family that was blighted with real-life tragedy. His father, Junius Brutus Booth, had suffered from bouts of insanity, and Edwin's brother, John Wilkes Booth, famously assassinated Abraham Lincoln in 1865. This event cast a huge shadow over the rest of Edwin's life and career. He was never able to shake it off. In 1882, Irving invited Booth to play Othello in London, opposite his Iago. Booth's Othello was described by his biographer William Winter as affluent with feeling, eloquent, picturesque, and admirable for sustained power and symmetry. In 1890, Booth made a private recording for his wife of Othello's speech to the Senate, which I think is full of quiet dignity. And does one detect in this restrained and almost naturalistic delivery the beginnings of an understanding and sensitivity towards the new technology?
Her father and husband asked his greatest few questions in the story of the late frontier to me. But that is what I have done. I ran it through from the boy's days to the very moment that he then began, wherein I speak of most disastrous chances of losing accident by bloodless of air breath gates of the imminent deadly boot of being taken by the insolent bull and soul to fail. Of the redemption things and potent in the travel history, wherein Levanta's vast and desert side, I rock the forest of the hill, such heaven it was redemption. Such was potent. And of the cannibals that others, the anthropophagi of men who came to grow their shoulders. These things to hear were Desdemona's serious decline, but still the house affairs of Broadhurst, which can likely go to hate the past, come again, and with a gloomy fear the power of rising soul. Which I am serving, was the player's hour, and found good means to draw from her a prayer of earnest heart, that I would all the pilgrimage dining, whereof by passing had something there but not. I did convince, and often did beguile her of her tears when I did speak of something dreadful to those the story being done, she gave me for the pains of worldly life. She swore in faith to a slave. Was passion was pitiful, was wonderful pitiful. She wished she had not heard it, yet she wished that heaven had made her such a man. She thanked. And that me, if I had a friend that loved her, I should but teach him how to tell my story, and that would do her. Upon this thing, I say, she loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved her that she did.
Yes, difficult to hear that one. He recorded that in his front room at home for his wife, as I said, and it was a birthday present for her, so it's very much on primitive home equipment, home recording in its very earliest stages there. But even so, Booth's delivery is so much less artificial for the period, 1890. Remember the level that Irving was playing Richard III on, which is only 2 years before this recording. And the performance has a pace which is very uncharacteristic of acting in this period, at least on this side of the Atlantic. In the wake of this new technological development, the desire to be as natural as possible in Shakespeare became the actor's journey in the 20th century. To seek to create an intimacy in the delivery of a Shakespeare speech, to explore the subtlety of the unprojected voice, became a quest that would have been impossible to achieve and indeed unthought of in the 19th century. One actor that we can chart on this journey is Sir John Gielgud. His career spanned most of the 20th century. His first stage appearance was in 1911 at the age of 7, and his last was in a film adaptation of Beckett's Catastrophe just weeks before his death in 2000. Included in this long career is a substantial legacy of recorded Shakespeare, both for the BBC and commercial recording companies. This early recording of Hamlet, made for Linguaphone in 1930, was when Gielgud was only 26, but he had already played the part at the Old Vic.
How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. What is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed? A beast no more. Sure, he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused. Now, whether it be bestial oblivion, or some craven scruple, or thinking too precisely on the event, a thought which quartered hath but one part wisdom and ever three parts coward. I do not know why yet I live to say this thing's to do, sith I have cause and will and strength and means to do't. Examples gross as earth exhort me. Witness this army of such mass and charge, led by a delicate and tender prince, whose spirit, with divine ambition puffed, makes mouths at the invisible event, exposing what is mortal and unsure to all that fortune, death, and danger dare, even for an eggshell. Rightly to be great is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw, when honor's at the stake. How stand I then, that have a father killed, a mother stained, excitements of my reason and my blood, and let all sleep, while to my shame I see the imminent death of 20,000 men who, for a fantasy and trick of fame, go to their graves like beds, fight for a plot whereon the numbers cannot try the cause, which is not tomb enough and continent to hide the slain. Oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth.
Now, I don't know what you think about that, but for me, in that recording, Gielgud seems to be overshadowed by the 19th century. The acting tradition, which was indeed his background, he was related to Ellen Terry and had a highly developed instinct for theatrical tradition. His sense of rhetoric and poetry could dominate his performance as a young man, and to be fair, Sir John was well aware of this tendency in himself. He wrote in his memoirs, "I was inclined to show off in my verse speaking, which was becoming too much like singing. I dare say I was somewhat smug after a few recent successes." Sir John, probably more than any other actor of his generation, learnt how to play the microphone. He recorded his solo Shakespeare recital, The Ages of Man, in the 1960s, and he said at the time, "I discovered that in doing speeches out of their proper context, I had to remember that in every speech there was a rise, a climax, and a fall, having in mind where I was going to and where I was coming from. And then I could put any amount of variations in between, as musicians often do in playing Chopin, for instance, while keeping the essential architecture of each speech intact. Now listen to the same speech that we just heard in the 1930s extract from a BBC broadcast of Hamlet by Sir John 17 years later in 1947.
How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. What is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed, a beast no more? Sure he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fasten us unused. Now, whether it be bestial oblivion, or some craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, a thought which quartered hath but one part wisdom and ever three parts cowards, I do not know why, yet I live to say this thing's to do, sith I have cause and strength and will and means to do it. Examples gross as earth exhort me. Witness this army of such mass and charge, led by a delicate and tender prince, whose spirit with divine ambition puffed, makes mouths at the invisible event, exposing what is mortal and unsure to all that fortune, death, and danger dare, even for an eggshell. Rightly to be great is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor's at the stake. How stand I then that have a father killed, a mother stained, excitements of my reason and my blood, and let all sleep, whilst to my shame I see the imminent death of 20,000 men that for a fantasy and trick of fame go to their graves like beds, fight for a plot whereon the numbers cannot try the cause, which is not tomb enough nor continent to hide the slain. Go from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth.
I'm sure I don't need to point out the difference there that 17 years made. And amazingly, that is 37 seconds shorter than the 1930s extract. That tells us a lot about the pace. As one could hopefully discern in the very primitive recording of Edwin Booth we heard, difficult as it was, it is to the Americans that we must look for the first development of a naturalistic approach to the speaking of Shakespeare. With the advent of electrical recording in the 1920s, where a microphone was first used and the volume could be controlled by an amplifier, the quality of reproduction significantly improves, and the style of acting begins to adapt to this more sophisticated advance. An actor who was perfectly at ease with the medium and used it to enhance and increase the effectiveness of his performance was John Barrymore. Like Edwin Booth, he belonged to a theatrical dynasty, and some critics think that he could have been as great a Shakespearean actor as Booth. He was a sensational Hamlet in 1922 on both sides of the Atlantic. But he turned instead to Hollywood, became a matinee idol, and embarked on a destructive and dissipated lifestyle. His brother, Lionel, said that John, or Jack, as he called him, got as quickly bored playing the same part as he did living with the same woman. When John Barrymore came to London in 1925 to play Hamlet, it was the hot ticket of the season, though it is said that he rehearsed in a broad American accent to put the fear of God into the English cast, who thought that he was going to play it like that. Needless to say, on the first night, he had impeccable English pronunciation. The ease and the confidentiality of his delivery in this speech from Hamlet show his experience in the subtle world of film.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. To die to sleep no more. And by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die. To sleep. To sleep. A chance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, must give us pause. The undiscovered country, from whose bourne no traveler returns, puzzles the will and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all. Thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with a pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pith and moment with this regard their currents turn awry, lose the name of action.
Barrymore's London Hamlet had a profound effect on at least one young actor who was still learning his craft at that time, Laurence Olivier. As he recalled in his book on acting, a man came to London, a man who was very special, very immediate and very different. He was from another planet as far as my young eyes were concerned. There he was. The amazing Jack Barrymore, on stage at the Haymarket. Everything about him was exciting. He was athletic, he had charisma, and to my young mind, he played the part to perfection. Although American, his English was perfect. My Hamlet in later years owed a great deal to Jack Barrymore. It seemed to me that he breathed life into the character, which, since Irving, had been lulled into arias and false inflections, all very beautiful and poetic, but castrated. Barrymore put the balls back. He had a way of choosing a word and then exploding it in a moment of passion. Perhaps you did not agree with the choice, but it was constantly riveting. He would vary pace, but never gabble, always understandable. And when Olivier came to make his film version of Hamlet in 1947, Barrymore's influence was there.
That this too solid flesh would melt, thaw and resolve itself into a dew, or that the everlasting had not fixed his cannon against self-slaughter. O God, God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fiat, afi. 'Tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. That it should come to this, but 2 months dead. Nay, not so much, not 2. So excellent a king that was to this Hyperion to a satyr. So loving to my mother that he might not suffer the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth, must I remember? Why, she would hang on him as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on. And yet within a month, let me not think on it. Frailty, thy name is woman. A little month. Or ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body, like Niobe, all tears, why she, even she,
O God, a beast that once discourse of reason would have mourned longer.
Marriage with my uncle. My father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules. Within a month, she married. Oh, most wicked speed to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. It is not, nor it cannot come to good. But break my heart, for I must hold my tongue.
It was always Olivier's intention to make Shakespeare sound modern. When watching film versions of Shakespeare, he became aware that there was a quarrel between the eye and the ear, between the behaviour of the camera and Shakespeare's verse. Time and time again, he wrote, I saw actors who had to come down on the big Shakespeare moments because of the proximity of the camera. More flexibility, poise and balance were needed between Shakespeare's words and the actions of the camera. Coordination. If Shakespeare has a flourish and a big speech, bring the camera back. If he has moments of humour and poignancy, bring it forward. Well, he might just as well have replaced the word camera with microphone, for the same technique applies in radio. Yet, despite undoubtedly moving the style of playing Shakespeare forward, when Olivier came to play Henry V, he admitted his debt to the past. I played the man like a trumpet, as clearly and truthfully as I knew how. I'm not ashamed to say that I stole from people. As I have said, I admired Barrymore and used much of his Hamlet in mine. In the case of Henry V, I have to acknowledge some of Lewis Waller's performance. I was fascinated by his vocal acrobatics, and I'm certain some of them lingered on within me, honed to my performance, of course, but still there. Well, let's see. Here they are, back to back, performing the same speech. First, Lewis Waller, the great matinee idol of the Edwardian times, recorded in 1911.
Once more under the breach, once more, dear friends, or close the wall up with our English dead. In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage. Then rend the eye a terrible aspect, let it fly through the portage of the head like a brass cannon. Now set the teeth and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hard the breath, and bend up every spirit to its full height. On, you noblest English, whose blood is set from fathers of war proof. Fathers that, like so many Alexanders, have in these parts from morn till even fought, and sheathed their swords from lack of argument. Dishonor not your mothers. Now attest that those whom you call fathers did beget you. Be copy now to men of grosser blood, and teach them how to war. And you, good yeoman, whose limbs were made in England, show us cure the mettle of your passion. Let us swear that you are worth your breeding, which I doubt not, for there is none of you so mean and base that hath not noble luster in your eyes. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slip, straining upon the start. The game's afoot, follow your spirit, and upon this charge, cry God for Harry, England, and St. George!
And now Olivier in his famous film version of Henry V in 1944.
With our English dead.
In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility.
But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage. Then lend the eye a terrible aspect, let it pry through the portage of the head like the brass cannon. Let the brow overwhelm it as fearfully as doth a galled rock, or hang and jutty his confounded base, swilled with the wild and wasteful ocean. Now set the teeth and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hard the breath and bend up every spirit to his full height. On, you noblest English, whose blood is fet from fathers of war proof. Fathers that, like so many Alexanders, have in these parts from morn till even fought and sheathed their swords for lack of argument. Dishonor not your mothers. Now attest that those whom you called fathers did beget you. Be copy now to men of grosser blood and teach them how to war. And you, good yeomen, whose limbs were made in England, show us here the mettle of your pasture. Let us swear that you are worth your breeding, which I doubt not, for there is none of you so mean and base that have not noble luster in your eyes. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slip, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit. And upon this charge, cry God for Harry, England and St. George!
You can certainly hear the trumpet, can't you? Alas, there isn't time to investigate the contribution of the BBC Drama Department that they have made to the playing of Shakespeare. The very first dramatic broadcast was in the year of the BBC's creation, 1922, and consisted of scenes from Julius Caesar. And since then, Shakespeare's been a sort of in-house writer for them, really. The drama department encouraged a naturalistic style of acting absolutely necessary for radio drama to be effective, and the speaking of Shakespeare would never be the same again. The ambition amongst actors since the introduction of radio has been to find an acceptable style for Shakespeare today that will sound as naturalistic and accessible as modern drama, while still staying within the classical poetic structure. A master of this multimedia approach to Shakespeare is, of course, Kenneth Branagh. He's at home in the film studio as much as the theatre, and he is no stranger to the microphone, using every possible nuance of his voice to illuminate the text, yet always managing to stay naturalistic. From the recording of Richard III that we made for Naxos, listen now to Richard's speech the night before the Battle of Bosworth. And notice how Branagh uses the microphone to take us right inside the mind of Richard.
Give me another horse. Bind up my wounds. Have mercy. Tissue. Soft. I did but dream. Oh, coward conscience, how dost thou afflict me? The lights burn blue. It is not dead midnight. Cold, fearful drops stand on my trembling flesh. What? Do I fear myself? There's none else by. Richard loves Richard. That is, I am I. Is there a murderer here? No. Yes. I am. Then fly. What, from myself? Great reason why, lest I revenge. What? Myself upon myself? Alack, I love myself. Wherefore, for any good that I myself have done unto myself? Oh, no. Alas, I rather hate myself for hateful deeds committed by myself. I am a villain, yet I lie. I am not. Fool of thyself, speak well. Fool. Do not flatter. My conscience hath a thousand several tongues, and every tongue brings in a several tale, and every tale condemns me for a villain. Perjury in the highest degree, murder, stern murder in the direst degree, all several sins, all used in each degree, throng all to the bar, crying all guilty, guilty. I shall despair. There is no creature loves me. And if I die, no soul shall pity me. Nay, wherefore should they, since that I myself find in myself no pity to myself? Methought the souls of all that I had murdered came to my tent, and every one did threat tomorrow's vengeance on the head of Richard.
And so to conclude, it seems that every generation of classical actor has striven to perform Shakespeare in a realistic and latterly a naturalistic way, always dictated, of course, by the tastes and acceptable standards of his own time. Since the 20th century, actors have been assisted and also challenged by the development of mechanical and electronic media, but these will be of no use without a thrilling and exciting interpretation from the actor. We've heard how actors of the caliber of Gielgud and Olivier acknowledge their debts to past actors. And it is this passing of the baton of style from one generation to the next and how they subsequently interpret it that I find so interesting. Edward Gordon Craig, the great visionary of theatre design, once said, "Never copy the old, but never forget the old, for there is always some good to be found in it." And if an actor wants to know how to speak Shakespeare today, then 400 years on, you cannot do better than return to the bard himself. Whatever media had been invented since 1600, whatever media will subsequently be invented in this and future centuries, Hamlet's advice to the players really covers everything you need to know. "Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of our players do, I had as lief the town crier spoke my lines. Nor do not saw the air too much with your hand thus, but use all gently. For in the very torrent, tempest, and as I may say, whirlwind of your passion, you must acquire and beget a temperance that may give it smoothness. Be not too tame neither, but let your own discretion be your tutor. Suit the word to the action to the word, with this special observance that you o'erstep not the modesty of nature. For anything so overdone is from the purpose of playing, whose end both at first and now was and is to hold, as 'twere, the mirror up to nature, to show virtue her own feature, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time, his form and pressure." Thank you very much.